From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A new report brings some troubling news for those surveying the Syrian landscape for the so-called moderate rebels that officials in Washington seem to favor. RT's Polly Boyko reports.
This is a study that's been released by a think tank called the Center on Religion and Geopolitics, and it's found that there are around 60% of Syria's rebels broadly have the same aims as those fighting for the Islamic State. The report also warns that even if IS is defeated, those leftover jihadists could cause real havoc. There's also the issue of trying to distinguish between what is a moderate and an extremist Syrian rebel. The report says that trying to distinguish between rebels is bound to fail because they do share similar aims. And both the British and the US governments have had trouble coming up with a definition of a moderate Syrian rebel in the past.
Don't you need to be totally satisfied that these people are not, you know, rampant human rights abusers and beheaders? You know, what is it that gets them across that hurdle?
I don't think we can enumerate it.
Well, many will know that Russia's definition of rebels in Syria has been somewhat different. We can take a listen to Russian foreign minister giving his definition of what a terrorist is rather succinctly.
If it looks like a terrorist, if it acts like a terrorist, if it walks like a terrorist, if it fights like a terrorist, it's a terrorist, right?
But of course, international efforts are being made to get both the Syrian government and opposition groups around the negotiating table as part of the Vienna process. But because of this lack of agreement over who is and who isn't a terrorist, there are sticking points. So this report, which is talking about looking at all the groups in Syria as a whole, rather than just focusing on IS, is extremely relevant at the moment.
Meanwhile, the humanitarian catastrophe created by those groups and their international sponsors continues. The UN Security Council heard Monday that, despite the efforts of UN and other humanitarian groups to provide assistance to the millions of people affected by the Syrian conflict, much more is needed. UN Assistant Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Kyung-Hwa Kang, told the council that the latest plan calls for nearly $3.2 billion to assist the 13.5 million people in the country in need for next year. Deanne Penn filed this report.
Ms. Kang told the Security Council that over half the Syrian population has been displaced since the crisis began nearly 5 years ago. Some 6.5 million people are displaced within Syria, and more than 4 million have fled the country, mostly to neighboring states. In the past months, the UN and its partners were only able to reach 32% of hard-to-reach locations. She called on the authorities to approve 47 pending convoy requests and for armed groups, including terrorist groups, to allow deliveries to proceed.
As we enter a new year, we must do our utmost to bring hope back to Syrians who have suffered too much. The conflict must be brought to an end through a comprehensive political solution addressing its underlying causes. We pin our hopes on the efforts of the International Support Group for Syria and are encouraged by the resolution this Council adopted on the 18th of December.
UN High Commissioner for Refugees Antonio Guterres reported that Syrians comprised half of the nearly 1 million people who arrived by boat in Europe this year. He said Syrians will continue to try to reach Europe unless there is a fundamental change in the factors pushing them to leave. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
The leaders of two major left-wing parties in Spain say they will vote against a new government of the ruling People's Party, even if it manages to form a coalition government. Podemos's Pablo Iglesias spoke a day after the general election Sunday.
They can't count on us to hand over the government to Mariano Rajoy. Neither the Citizens' Party nor the Popular Party can count with our support to give the presidency to Mariano Rajoy. We will not allow this in any way.
The Podemos leader said he's optimistic that his bloc would do even better if snap elections were to be held. And Socialist Party Secretary Cesar Luna said his bloc will also not support the People's Party.
The Socialist Party will vote no to the candidacy of Rajoy. In the vote of confidence, we will vote no to the People's Party. The Socialist Party, out of prudence and responsibility, will have a clear position. The Spanish people have voted for change and also for the left, and we will translate that vote of the Spanish people in the votes or vote of confidence.
Political commentator Isaac Bijou, speaking with Press TV's Marzia Hashemi, laid out the current configuration in the new legislature.
Well, in Spain, the president has to have the support, in order to be elected, he needs to have the support of the majority of 350 deputies. But, however, Rajoy, who won the election, has only 123. He has lost one-third of his congressmen and almost half of his votes. So with 123 congressmen, it is quite difficult for him to be a president, to be elected president. He needs almost 60 new congressmen to have an absolute majority. And there is, he can have the support of the citizen, which is a right-wing party, but they don't want to support him. Perhaps the nationalist parties, but the nationalist parties or the independents or a referendum on independence which he's against. So I don't see him with the possibility of being elected as president. Another possibility will be a great coalition with the Socialist Party, but at the moment the Socialist Party is rejecting it because the Socialist Party thinks that if they make an alliance with Podemos and the nationalists, they can be elected in power.
Today's feature story is focused on a conference set for next month at Philadelphia's Temple University. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford has more.
On January 8th through the 10th, Philadelphia's Temple University will host a conference on the Black Radical Tradition. Keynote speakers include Angela Davis, Robin D.G. Kelly, Cornell West, Vijay Prashad, Anthony Montero, and Charlene Carruthers of Chicago's Black Youth Project 100. The title of the conference is Reclaiming Our Future, the Black Radical Tradition in Our Time. Larry Hamm, chairman of the Newark, New Jersey-based People's Organization for Progress, will take part in one of the conference panels. There has not been a mass movement in Black America for a very long time. We asked Larry Hamm if the Black radical tradition is more than just an academic subject.
I think there is a growing reservoir of discontent in the Black community that folks have tapped into. I think that in the Black community, there always has been a reservoir of anti-establishment feeling. The question has always been, can you get people to move from feeling discontent to actually voicing their discontent and then actively organizing and mobilizing around that discontent. Now, over the decades, I have seen this section of the population kind of ebb and flow. In the period right after the civil rights movement period called the Black Power Movement, a lot of that discontent was channeled into electoral politics. I mean, essentially, I think, although there were different strands in the Black Power Movement, different tendencies, different organizations that had different approaches, I think overall, when you said Black Power to someone, they thought of political power in the main, and that political power manifesting itself in the electoral arena. So a lot of that, you know, after the Civil Rights Act was passed and the Voting Rights Act and millions of Black people getting registered and voting for the first time, voting Black folks at all, that's where a lot of that discontent went. And what we saw, the fruit of the Black Power Movement, was a tenfold increase in Black elected officials. And you saw a waning in the street of the movement and the directing of the masses toward the ballot box. And for a period that went even in probably the 1980s, you saw a waning of the mass movement in the streets and an increase in this electoral activity. But then I would say somewhere around the mid to late 70s, many black people began to discover that simply electing black people to office was in fact not bringing about a major change in their material condition. Now, I think it's important to note that that's how some people felt. But on the other hand, there was a section of the black community for whom some aspects of their material condition did change. For instance, many who would not have gotten the opportunity to go to college were able to get to college, and as a result of that, they were able to get better jobs, so on and so forth. Even in the working class, black people were able to avail themselves of more jobs in the auto industry and in government jobs. So for a section of the people, there was some improvement. But for the lower part of the working class, the underclass, the actual material conditions either didn't improve or in fact got worse. And so we saw this discontent begin to grow and grow and grow. And it has manifested itself at different times. More recently, in recent years, we have seen a lot of that discontent moved into mass action because of the issue of police brutality. Now, we have a new wave of anti-police brutality activity, but there has always been movement around the issue of police brutality. In fact, if we go all the way back to the 60s, almost every rebellion that occurred, and there were over 1,000 of them that occurred between 1960 and 1972, almost every one of them was triggered by either an act of police brutality or an act of racist violence, or in many cases, the two were the same. So there always was activity around the issue of police brutality at various times. That piece. And so now we're seeing this most recent wave with the Black Lives Matter movement, and we see a lot of young people who are alienated and disaffected, who are unemployed. Many of them have even gone to college and come home, not able to get jobs. They comprise a part of that reservoir of discontent and anti-establishment feeling. Many black folks who have lost their homes due to the foreclosure crisis, many more black people who lost their jobs due to the economic crisis, and on and on and on. So I think the reservoir of discontent is there. I think it has been tapped into by recent movements. I mean, we could go back to Genesis 6. You know, I think the Genesis 6 movement showed some of that discontent. And then, you know, all the movements that have followed that up to these anti-police brutality movements, which includes Black Lives Matter. So I think it's there. I think that the conference is needed because we do need a theoretical perspective and a theoretical understanding of what is happening. And at the same time, those who are involved in the theoretical work need to hear from people who are involved in the practical work, the actual organizing on the ground, so that we can have a synthesis of the two and in fact raise all our consciousness to a higher level. So that's why I think this and other conferences like it are important. I mean, I'm mainly a street activist. I'm in no way even considered any kind of intellectual or theoretical worker, but I understand the value of that. I understand the value of having people who can really dissect this system and help us to understand how it's functioning and help us to understand how its processes are impacting our lives. And more importantly, help us to understand how we can fight against it more effectively. So I see value in conferences like the Black Radical Tradition. So I'm hoping that I will learn some things, and I'm hoping that I can maybe even bring a perspective that might offer a little value to some of the people that are there.
Oh, I think Larry Hamm and People's Organization for Progress are solidly and genuinely part of the Black Radical Tradition. Some would say that this black radical tendency or tradition is marked by a commitment to social transformation with an emphasis on black self-determination. What would you say?
I would agree with that. I think it's very important for us to understand what we mean when we say the black radical condition. So let me say what I think, because I don't know that even among black radicals, there's often disagreement on how we see things. But when I think of the black radical tradition, I think of those persons and movements who have not only been fighting for progressive reform, but who understand fundamentally that the big problems that face black people and other working and poor and oppressed people in this country really cannot be adequately solved until we fundamentally change our socioeconomic system. I think the black radical tradition is about those people who have had a clear anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist view on these things, who understand, in fact, how the system of capitalism has created the very problems that we struggle against on a daily basis, and how the imperialist system, that expression of capitalism abroad, from the capitalist countries to the underdeveloped countries that they exploit abroad, how even that process of imperialist exploitation and domination is in fact connected to the system of oppression and exploitation right here in our own country. There are many people who fight on a daily basis and who fight the good fight, who fight for reforms that will help somebody. You know, I always keep in mind the saying, it's better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. So some of these reforms do help a few people, and if it puts a few people back to work or keeps a few people from being homeless or keeps a few schools from closing, I say right on. But we don't just want to put a few people back to work. We want to eliminate unemployment and have a system that can provide jobs at a living wage for everyone. We don't just want to keep a few schools from closing. We want to keep all schools open and provide not just adequate, but provide quality education for all young people. We don't just want to be able to get a few homeless people off the street and put them into shelters. We want to eliminate homelessness and eliminate an economic system that, in fact, creates homelessness and poverty, and eliminate an international system. We don't just want to end wars, we want to end an international economic and political system, which many of us call imperialism, that in fact creates war, that in fact thrives off war, that in fact war is in fact its reason for being, you know. So that's what I think of when I think of the black radical tradition. I'm thinking of people who want to go to the root. As I understand, the definition of the word radical means going to the root, to eliminate the root cause, not just eliminate the problems, which are very serious, but which are in fact manifestations of a problematic system that we live under.
Much of the black political ferment nowadays centers around the police. Do you see the seeds or evidence of a larger kind of black radical perspective emerging from the current incipient movement?
Absolutely. I think that there has been a significant leap in people's consciousness and thinking about the police that has occurred just over the last few years. I think part of that, of course, has to do with the technological advances that have allowed everyone now to, in fact, carry a telephone, which is also a video camera, in their pocket, and in fact film these police in the act of brutality and abuse and even murder, and get those videos out to folks. Just, I think just seeing that, it might be difficult for people to see it now, But I'm telling you, just 5 years ago, it was hard to convince some black people that there was police brutality, much less the white people. So, but I'm not talking about Uncle Tom's, and I'm not talking about establishment black folk that work for the government and work. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about every day. People would be surprised. You know, the masses are the masses. They're people. They're people who have all different kinds of thoughts. Yes, there is a general kind of opposition that the masses have to oppression, and that has a lot to do with their material condition. But you'd be surprised, even among black working people, how much of a conservative tendency exists on certain questions. And because black folk are so plagued by crime, because we live in poverty-stricken communities and live in situations where we have generations of folk living in poverty, there's a big concern about crime and violence and homicide. And you'd be surprised, some folks would be surprised at how much we have to struggle sometimes. You know, we'll be standing on the corner having a demonstration against police brutality, and somebody will walk by, and it ain't anybody working in City Hall. Somebody will walk by like, why are y'all demonstrating against the police? Why are y'all not out here demonstrating against the killing in our own community? You know, and when the Black Lives Matter slogan began to bubble up from people, then there was this counter reaction. Black people must love black lives. You know, why y'all just talk about Black Lives Matter when you talk about white police killing us? Why you don't talk about the black on black killing? So these conditions that people face in their everyday lives cause folks to have certain kinds of ideas on things. And sometimes those ideas don't jive with our radical view and radical perspective on things and present real challenges to us in terms of organizing oppositional movements, and even more so, not just organizing oppositional movements, but organizing truly radical movements. Now, I do have to add this point, and that is I am buoyed by the fact that more than any time since I have been in college, and I left Princeton University in 1980, more than any other time since I left college, I have heard more real anti-capitalist sentiment than I have ever heard before. And of course, I'm hearing it in movement circles. I'm also hearing it more in academic circles. I go in and out of those circles because sometimes I'm asked to come and speak to students on college campuses, you know, about the work of the People's Organization for Progress. But I also hear it. You'd be surprised. I hear it going back and forth to work and sitting and talking with coworkers. There's really a more discussion going on now about capitalism. And there's really more anti-capitalist sentiment and anti-corporate sentiment. I'm talking about in the black community now, not just among the white community, white progressives. I'm hearing more anti-capitalist sentiment and anti-corporate sentiment than I've heard since I left Princeton University in 1980. My spirits are lifted by that in terms of the potential now for, you know, real radical movements to begin to take hold.
Black radicalism has been historically anything but quiet. It's been very contentious within the ranks of black radicals. Is that a good thing? And might we look forward to some of that in Philadelphia in January?
Oh, I'm sure. Contention has always been a characteristic of the left, because the left, even the black left, has various tendencies. One of the aspects I've noticed about trying to organize in the black community is that our people have been so oppressed and so exploited and so beaten down that when you're in a hole down far enough, 10 feet up might feel like progress. Now, you're not out of the hole, but 10 feet up might feel like progress. So black folks' lives are so difficult that some strategies for organizing, which would be rejected in some circles, still hold currency. Like the whole aspect, the whole belief that business can be a emancipatory strategy. The whole discussion that's going on now, and in a strange kind of way, I believe this thinking is manifest in the boycott movement. Now, I support boycott. You know, I think that the Montgomery bus boycott was a wonderful thing, and I believe in the weapon of boycotts, and POP right now, POP is in working with other groups, including the NAACP and New Jersey Citizen Action. We boycotted Panasonic because of the way they've been treating black women over there. So I support boycott. But when I listen to some of the discussions that go on in the black community, I think a lot of that discussion is buttressed by a belief in capitalism that somehow if black people develop enough black businesses, that will be a strategy for emancipation. Now, do I think black business is a good thing? I think that anyone who has the wherewithal to create a business that will make them self-sufficient, you help them pay their bills and support their families and so on and so forth, I think that's a good thing. But will that be a strategy that can, in fact, liberate the masses of people? I don't think so.
So this is Christmas. What have you done? Another year over, and a new one just begun. And so this is Christmas. I hope you have fun. The near and the dear ones, they're all. So happy.